This is WGN Radio. Tom Gimbel is the job expert we often call, the founder of the LaSalle Network, to talk about some of the issues in the business world these days. And today, Tom, it's a little bit about AI. It's always about AI these days, isn't it?
Was that a Fletch reference?
A Fletch reference?
Oh, when you said it's all about ball bearings these days.
Oh, wow. Wow, nice movie drop there. That went right by me. No, I don't know that one, but...
I appreciate it.
I was looking at this one story that talked about using AI to help with your resume or your cover letter or anything else in your job search. What do you think about that?
I think people have been going to resume writers since the moment we had resumes. And I think that if you go to a human resume writer, it's okay. And if you go to a machine one, it's not. I totally think that that's crazy. I think that people using technology, whether it be an electric can opener versus doing it by hand, or a tow truck rather than pushing it, or AI to help you create a resume or a cover letter, that it's okay. Now, I think on the flip side, the person who receives it also has the ability to use their determination whether they think it's original or whether they think you copied it or formatted it or what have you. And that's called, you know, everybody's got the ability to interpret information the way they want to.
Okay, so, but you said, that's crazy. And I'm not hearing you correctly.
I think it's crazy to view it as a negative.
Ah, yeah, right. Because why? I mean, so the advantage is that it might help you organize your thoughts or your work history in a way that you didn't know how to do it. And if it's a tool to help you, then why are you fighting it?
Yeah, a resume is a marketing tool. And so if my brain doesn't work the right way on a marketing tool, on marketing, as somebody else's does, and I don't have the money to go to a resume writer, then why can't I use a computer to do that? I just think that the fact that we would judge somebody for using technology. Now, if ChatGPT or whatever AI device that we're using formats them exactly the same, and I'm now receiving a resume and they all look exactly the same, now the playing field's even. So that's okay. And if I think that you did something, if I think your cover letter sounds fake, then that's not good. But if I think your cover letter sounds creative, then it worked positively. Let's move a step forward, John. You get the job, and then you're using AI and ChatGPT working for that company now to help them secure more revenue. And they would say to you, I assume they would say to you, if it helps us get the client, that's great. If it helps us lose the client, you're not using it correctly. So, you know, this goes back to one of my theories. Growing up in grade school, high school, college, they teach you that plagiarism is bad. When you get into the workforce, all we do is cut and paste different proposals from different areas of the company and use them in different ways, whether you're at Fortune 500 or startup. Netflix has their culture deck that's online, and Sequoia Venture Capitalist has their board presentation deck online. Everybody's copying and stealing from one another. As long as it's not copyrighted or trademarked, that's legal. But yet when we get to something on an individual level, we say we shouldn't do it, but for business, we should. I totally disagree, and I think that if AI and technology can help somebody who can't afford a resume writer or a career coach, and it can supplant that, God bless them. Use it.
Do you worry that, or do you dislike maybe when people use certain buzzwords or phrases that sound pretty generic? They aren't really personalized or maybe truly individual. And I think that's what an AI software package might do if you were asking it to write a resume for me. It doesn't know me. It's just a computer spitting out stuff. I bet that you get a lot of the gobbledygook that you see when you do that.
MBA graduates have been using gobbledygook and buzzwords for decades.
Yeah, but that's not a good thing, is it?
Well, they get paid for it, so I don't know. I think that when you read something, if something's representing me, and if I'm going to read it and I understand it, then that's okay. If it's representing me and I read it and I don't understand it, then that's not okay. and in my summation, right?
Okay. But then it sounds like you're not that interested in the art of a resume or a cover letter. You want the nuts and bolts. You want just a description of who this person is, what they can accomplish.
In a way that there's nothing wrong with paint by numbers if you can't see the lines and you can't see the numbers.
Yeah.
Everybody's looking for Picasso, but there's only one of him and he's dead. And now they want to cancel him because he was a misogynist. So, you know what, you pick your poison. I think we're trying to do a broad brush on everybody and everything all the time. And I think that if you can get a job using your resume and doing it on your own, Godspeed. If you can't and you need some help and you want to use technology to do it, even better.
That's Tom Gimbel with thoughts on your job search and art history. Okay, Tom, always nice to talk to you. He's the expert on jobs and the founder of the LaSalle Network. Let's talk next week, my friend.
You got it. Maybe the heat's getting to me, but I'm fired up today, Jeff.
I kind of noticed. And Philip Weiss joins us as the president of SciFarth at Work with a lesson to learn from the Kamala Harris campaign for president, I guess, right? Philip, welcome to the show. How are you?
Great, John. Good to be here again. It's interesting conversation and chat we're hearing from different executives who watched as President Biden made the decision, and in his mind at least, rather suddenly, to step back. And they're taking a look at what the administration did well in terms of positioning Kamala Harris and what could have been done better. And the lessons coming out of this dramatic swing politically relate to the fact that a lot of leaders are telling us you really want to think that this could happen to any founder, any business leader. So early on, if you know who your successor might be, start to position them because you might be surprised at when you have to step back and others should be comfortable in that moment based on what you've already put into place.
I said, I guess, in saying, well, I guess it's Kamala Harris's presidential campaign. Clearly, she is the favorite and is campaigning, but she's not the nominee yet. And Joe Biden still hasn't technically released his delegates to then vote for her. But that's the process. And, you know, I was thinking that probably before he stepped down, if she was smart, she and her closest advisors were already anticipating that she might yet get the call. And then who would her number two be? I mean, I know she doesn't have much time to do this. It's expected she'll announce it by August 7th. But I wonder if she was kind of working on this, at least mentally thinking about that, Philip.
Yeah, that is actually a really interesting insight. The rapid fire way with on to messaging in a way that paired highly strategic, will believe that they've been at least thinking through her VP choice. So I wouldn't be surprised if your theory proves to be true when historians look back and they had a chosen favorite. And what's really interesting about that is it kind of applies on both sides. Biden did a good job, his administration did a good job of giving Kamala Harris a seat at the table when it came to key cabinet, congressional, and White House discussions on the big bills and laws he passed. So within the Beltway, she had a very visible seat. And that's something that business leaders have been thinking about. And now they're telling their own teams, let's make sure that my COO or my number two is sitting there next time we have a groundbreaking or we're closing a deal. I want them speaking, not just me. Because the idea of being at the table with the top person speaking up is one great way to get that visibility that will pay off later. So that's been a really interesting and valuable lesson to a lot of corporate leaders. And on the flip side, John, clearly the VP was thrown into some tough, hard-to-navigate waters when it came to legislation, immigration, voting rights. That's another lesson that corporate leaders are taking away. You want to give your chosen successor enough what we might call easy wins through their tenure so that when it's their time to step up, other people view them as highly capable. So it's both visibility and it's having enough of these wins in their pocket.
If she was in the room during some of these major discussions or decision processes by the president, I was unaware of that. One of the criticisms has been that we haven't seen her do that much. If she has actually been an effective member of the president's cabinet, then I think that has been lost in the coverage. You can't always control the coverage, but you can put that person in a position to maybe get some good press. I don't know that the Biden administration did a good job of that, if in fact she was that integral a player.
Yeah, that distinction is not lost on corporate leaders as well, John. So within the Beltway, in D.C. circles, if you talk to people behind the scenes on both sides of the aisle, they saw Kamala's integral role. But that is only half the picture, as you're stating accurately, John. The other side is, what is the country at large seen? And that's why you want to give your successor, be they a political or a business selection, enough access to these easier victories. And I'm not saying stuff that looks like it's a cakewalk, but you got to give them the chance to be there spearheading initiatives. And I'll give you a quick example of that. A marketing firm we train had a CEO that made a point of giving his next in line two highly visible projects a year, recording videos on new compensation structures that everyone was looking forward to, for example, so that when time came to step back and it was sudden, those wins were in people's collective memory. Hmm.
What if the CEO or whoever we're talking about needing a successor is doing a great job? Do you already have, though, somebody banked to replace them, or is that only a process that begins when trouble starts?
Well, you know, that is kind of the realization that many business leaders are facing, which is to say, Biden, we may have thought one thing as a collective voting public. He had to come around to the idea of stepping back. And many business leaders realize, perhaps unexpectedly, due to family or health considerations, or perhaps a surprise political appointment, that they do want to step back and didn't expect or think they would do so. So planning ahead as if it could happen in a month, 2 or 3 months, is a tremendously strategic approach. That's why thinking about how to position that person, how to be ready to introduce that person, is something that we don't want to wait for the 11th hour to do.
One last thing, then, the language you use to make that announcement is going to be finely parsed, isn't it? People will analyze exactly what you say, how and why you say it.
Yeah, that's as important as the positioning, John. I mean, any president, including Biden, has probably the best speech writers at his or her disposal. Corporate leaders, not always so much. So some of our clients are already looking at the language they might use, keeping an audit of what their chosen successor has done recently that would be important to promote. So if it happens, they can pull that draft, polish it up, and use it to make the succession happen smoothly.
Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work. I spell it SceyFarth. He does too. SciFarthatWork.com. Nice to talk to you, Philip.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure.
Jason Turner, the chief investment strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Big day. Well, I don't know if it's a big day, but it's another day of anticipation for what Jerome Powell and the Fed will signal. The meetings start today. Isn't that right, Jason?
Meetings start today, conclude tomorrow, and we'll be watching keenly the comments the chair and the Fed make coming out of the meeting tomorrow.
Would this be a meeting at which they could announce an interest rate drop, or are the meetings different? They have different agendas. They could have done it in July in this month, right?
Theoretically, they can make a move in July. Historically, the Fed has been very reticent to make moves in July. They just had a meeting in June. They have their annual conference in Jackson Hole in August, which tends to be a opportunity for them to hit a reset button on policy. So it's more likely them making moves in June and September as opposed to July.
I want to be in the Fed. They get to travel to cool places. They meet for a couple of days. There's all kinds of intrigue. You think that'd be a fun job or position to hold, Jason?
Oh, it might be a fun job, but it's also one where you get the finger pointed at you for big economic shifts, and even by those who appoint you tend to blame you for direction and change in the economy.
Although it does seem like they're due for some good news, right? I mean, it's expected that they'll drop rates one or two times, and people expect that and want that. It's just a matter of when now.
That's right. It's a matter of timing. And right now, the markets are pricing in a near certainty of a rate cut before the end of the year. That's almost completely priced into September at this point. And then the market's really pricing in about 70 basis points worth of rate cuts over the next several meetings. So we could see, let's call it two cuts by the end of the year if they cut in September and then again in December.
So you don't expect much market movement as a result if they do that? You think that's already there?
I think the first cut is largely symbolic. Market has been expecting this for quite some time. If you remember back in January, we thought they were going to cut six or seven times this year. So the market's been waiting on a park bench for the Fed to finally get off the sidelines and get active in terms of a cutting cycle. Likely, you get an immediate reaction day of the announcement, but not any sort of prolonged market directional change because the Fed has now officially made a cut. It's priced in.
Well, that's too bad then, because I think one of the reasons we want to see a rate cut is so that interest rates come down and that spurs investment and home sales. What's a reasonable expectation then going forward?
A reasonable expectation going forward is a continued slowing in the economy. I think we saw a surprisingly strong result in the second quarter from our GDP result. I think if we tear that apart, we start to notice that residential investment, you mentioned those home sales, those are still at a very slow level compared to where they've been in recent years. No real pickup there because rates are a quarter point lower. We'd likely need to get several cuts down the line. So talk spring of 2025 before you really see the housing market react to lower borrowing rates.
Well, in terms of home sales, that's not forever. I mean, if I wanted to sell my home in October, maybe I can wait until May. Do you think there will be real relief next spring? Do you think we'll see a noticeable change in, say, potential mortgage payments?
I think what we're seeing is, in effect, the soft landing the Fed has been talking about for a good year and a half now, starting to show us what it's going to look like in the coming quarters. I don't think you're going to get a large directional move to the positive late this year or early next year simply because the Fed has changed policy and borrowing rates are cheaper. But I think the declining growth rates or the contraction we've seen in the real estate market starts to abate once we see that, yes, the Fed is moving down in terms of rates. And it's important to note, we just observed that home prices are at all-time records. So in terms of average home prices. So we see an environment in which the average home buyer and seller are closer to equilibrium in the next couple of quarters than they've been in the last couple of quarters.
Markets seem to have plateaued of late, up and down, but they're not retreating that much. Where are we, do you think, in terms of the indices?
Well, we've seen an interesting movement in markets over the last two or three weeks, and this I'll line up with something we've talked about before, and that's concentration in indexes. The S&P 500 index of large cap U.S. stocks has 37.5% of its value in the top 10 names. Whenever that's gotten over 25%, we've seen a real shift in market behavior, and we've seen that over the last couple of weeks. Markets have largely moved to favor smaller names and more value-oriented names. Just to put that in context for the listeners, on a percentage basis over the last month, the really large growth stocks are down about 3.25%. Small value stocks are up over 11% just in the last month.
So what are some examples of those boring stocks or areas?
Well, the examples of the stocks that are taking on the chin, you look at NVIDIA down 6% today, it's those large technology companies that have really driven market performance recently, and that's why you see that disparity in the benchmarks. The ones that are doing all right in the current environment, surprisingly, for investors that have been enamored with this AI trend, are really the sleepy names within indices. Over the last month or so, the areas that have been the top performers in markets have been financials, utilities, the technology stocks and communication services stocks at the other end of that spectrum. So it's these sleepy companies where, importantly, valuation is not nearly as stretched as what we see in those large growth stocks.
What's your expectation for jobs for the second half of the year? What's employment going to be like?
I think we'll get a good window into that on Friday with Friday's jobs report. Expected to see that Friday job announcement be less than the prior month. We've seen downward revisions to four of the last 5 months. So the employment markets are sending, and the Fed is realizing that they're doing this, employment markets are sending messages that there's weakness in employment markets. Now, I don't think the unemployment rate moves up too much from the 4.1% it sits today. We may get to 4.2% by the end of the year. But we saw in today's JOLTS data, job openings have pulled back a little bit again. Hiring rate has pulled back a little bit. And the number of people quitting their jobs voluntarily moving to a better opportunity is at its lowest level since November of 2020.
Well,
we're definitely seeing some weakness.
One last thing from you, Jason. You're the chief investment strategist over at Wintrust Wealth. So I wonder what people should be thinking about with their investment portfolios, cash, bonds, stocks. Should people be repositioning things or holding pat? What's your overall advice right now?
This is a great time, given the volatility we've seen recently in markets and that performance disparity we already talked about, to remember that diversification is really your only free lunch in the investing world. Diversifying your assets away from things where you're over-concentrated, and the story of that concentration in the S&P 500 we talked about earlier is case in point. You get real yield in the bond market now. If you're a taxable investor in a mid to higher tax bracket, municipal bonds are yielding on an after-tax basis at an attractive rate. So if you're getting older and approaching retirement, have that retirement account and watch those equity values go up, now is a good time to take some of that money off the table, rebalance into areas that are going to be a little more stable, bonds and real assets, reset your asset allocation, and use that free lunch you get from diversification as a tool to help you weather any sort of storm going forward.
Okay, Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist, Wintrust Wealth Management, wintrustwealth.com. We'll talk again. Thanks for your help, Jason.
Thank you, John.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A fintech startup based in Chicago has secured new funding for its asset management platform. Geo Wealth finished a recent funding round with $18 million. Its platform already supports about $28 billion in assets with more than 180,000 accounts. Geo Wealth Services offers registered investment advisors a customizable and user-friendly platform. The new funding will help it further build out that platform. Some of the new capital will also be used to retire debt and expand the company's engineering team. Geo Wealth is planning further expansion this year. A Chicago company that's developing sustainable aircraft fuel says Airbus is one of its new strategic investors. LanzaJet's technology converts low-carbon ethanol into sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF, which cuts greenhouse gas emissions by more than 70% compared to fossil fuels. The announcement of the Airbus investment did not include a dollar figure, but LanzaJet says it will allow the company to continue to build its capability and capacity to scale the technology. It previously announced investments from Southwest Airlines and Microsoft, among others. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And last week, we checked in with our auctioneer friend, Dan Sullivan of Sullivan Auctions in West Central Illinois, who told us how well his son Michael is doing after a stem cell transplant at the Mayo Clinic.
He's doing great. Just very, very fortunate.
And as we reported, the Sullivans are so grateful that the stem cell transplant worked, they auctioned off a classic John Deere 4020, raised more than $500,000. All of which went to Mayo. But Mayo isn't the only place where these life-saving transplants are happening. Check out this number from Northwestern.
We do about 350 to 400 in a year.
More about that and how much easier it is now to be a donor than it used to be.
Very, very, very easy to do.
After, I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. There's never been a better time to go to BeTheMatch.org and register to be a bone marrow donor. Dan Sullivan was just telling us how easy it was for his daughter Gracie to donate marrow to save her brother Michael's life.
It took literally 4 days I would drop her off in front of the mail. I'd make a circle around the block, come back, and she'd be back down, ready to get back in. It was 4 days, and that process was not painful at all for her.
It wasn't always that easy.
Right. We used to harvest bone marrow by having to take up donors to the operating room and placing a large needle at the base of their back and physically extracting those stem cells.
That is
Dr. Jonathan Moreira. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in the Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University.
And he says if the idea of being put under and enduring pain is keeping you from being a bone marrow donor, that is no longer an excuse.
Most of the time it's done as an outpatient, and most of the time donors can go back to work the following day.
Not everyone gets as lucky as Michael Sullivan, whose sister was a match. That's why registering to be a donor at BeTheMatch.org is so important, and it's especially important for people of color.
Which is why it's really important to try to get all sorts of individuals to potentially sign up for them, because they could save a life without too much of an effort.
BeTheMatch.org.
And there might be somebody listening to your show, Steve, that will say, yeah, if it's that easy, I'm going to get into the system. You know, and a chance to be a donor, because you're talking about saving somebody's life.
BeTheMatch.org. On the food calendar, today's National Cheesecake Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Walking down the aisle of a store the other day, saw the school supplies, pencils, and all that stuff that the kids will need. Matt Adams is here. He's the principal at Deloitte Consulting, specializing in retail. And by the way, I just want to say, Matt, from the outset, that whoever puts your reports together, the graphics, the charts, the explanatory information, these are really well done. These are very easy to scan, see, and understand. It's a good report.
John, I appreciate that. We have a great team that works on it.
The graphics are amazing, but okay, enough about that. Let's just talk about the nuts and bolts of the thing. What are some of the takeaways from this report on back to school?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks again for having me, Jen. Always good to talk to you. Spend for parents. We survey parents around the Chicago area and nationally about what they're going to spend on their kids for back to school. And spend this year is up to $747 per student on average, up 14% from last year and up 27% relative to national. So it's a good story. It's parents really prioritizing their children, as they always seem to. Convenience is a big factor, the top priority for them in terms of where they choose to shop. Finances are still top of mind, that, you know, they still have a focus on deals. How can they make sure that they're extending their dollar as far as it'll go? But by and large, it's a pretty good story this year.
Are they shopping more online for school supplies, or are they shopping in those big box stores?
It's both of those things. And part of that is the convenience factor that I mentioned earlier. 70% of parents cite convenience as the top priority, and it comes down to great locations, being able to find multiple things in a single location online, as well as experiences, things like delivery capability to get it to your house, and easy returns.
So Target, Walmart, the usual suspects.
Yeah, generally speaking, yeah.
And then what about extracurricular activities? Is that included in the $747?
No, that's separate, actually. And it's another indication that parents are looking to spend. 9 out of 10 parents said they would be spending on extracurriculars at another $633 per child. And for them, it really comes down to seeing extracurriculars as an investment in their children's future and creating some mental well-being for them.
You know, it's funny because I think one way to color these numbers are, this is terrible, it's expensive, it's shocking. We're talking $1,300 to get a kid through school, and I presume we're including public schools in that. You see it as parents prioritizing, putting value in their children's education. It's great for the retailers, right?
Definitely good for retailers, and there is some, so I mentioned earlier that finances are still on mind, and there is some aspect of this that parents are citing just plain higher prices, although that's come down from last year, and the effect of inflation seems to be ebbing a little bit. But they also say, you know, 82% would be willing to splurge on a must-have back-to-school item for their kids. So there are some indications that people are, it is more about how they take care of their kids, the apparel, the technology they provide for them to make it a productive school year, as opposed to the burden of financial costs associated with back to school.
I suppose laptops aren't included in that. A lot of schools provide that, or families don't need to buy a new one every school year.
Yeah, what we saw the last couple years is technology spend decreased. And that was the explanation, or at least part of the explanation, is that schools are starting to provide some of those things. But we did see it bump back up again this year. Tech spend was up 29% relative to last year, to $560 per student for those who did spend on technology. So there are other, you know, gadgets and technology items that people are purchasing beyond the laptop that may be provided in some schools.
One last thing, is it keeping up with inflation or wages? I mean, I wonder, you know, if you could prorate this or compare it to previous years, what the spend is relative to people's income.
Yeah, we do see that the spend is increasing beyond increases in income or inflation, although that increased cost of goods is something that's in people's minds. We see household goods increasing 13% year over year, healthcare costs increasing 12%. So just basic needs are increasing. So that has stemmed some of the willful spend, the interest in spending, mm-hmm. But it is bigger than inflation and bigger than income increases.
Matt Adams is a principal at Deloitte Consulting, specializing in retail. It's a real nice report they put together, the 2024 Deloitte Back to School Survey here in Chicago. Click on Deloitte.com. Matt, we'll call you again. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.